Welcome to In My Backyard, an open conversation about children and mental health. We all know a child who's struggling, whether that child tells us or not. In this podcast, we speak with experts on the many factors of emotional distress in children, how to address those factors, and how to create a community where all children can be healthy and happy. This podcast is made possible through generous donations from supporters and listeners like you. Please visit tgclb.org or text HOPE to 562-262-5689 to make a one-time donation or join our Hope and Healing Club to become a monthly donor today. Your host is Tricia Costales, CEO of the Guidance Center, a nonprofit children's mental health agency in Long Beach, California.
I'm Tricia Costales, your host of In My Backyard. I'm a licensed clinical social worker and the chief executive officer of the Guidance Center, a nonprofit children's mental health agency serving 3,500 children and families every year. We've spoken in previous episodes about how emotional, psychiatric, and behavioral disorders in children are manifested in behaviors that often get them in trouble. These behaviors cause problems in school, trouble in the family and community, and, as we've learned, can lead to a juvenile probation system where as many as 90% of children have a mental health diagnosis. We were also lucky enough to hear from Dr. Bruce Perry of the Child Trauma Academy in Episode 7, where he explained how trauma is often the root cause of the problematic behaviors that we see. As Dr. Perry has written, all children experience stressful events, starting school, moving homes, welcoming a new sibling. When any child is exposed to stressful external events, the brain triggers an adaptive response. For some, this might be a state of hyperarousal, or what we might call flight or fight. In others, it might trigger a dissociative response, or what we might call freezing or tuning out. For many, there might be a combination of both. We all experience stress throughout our lives. For a child raised with healthy adult relationships and a relatively trauma-free upbringing, experiencing normal stressors is a positive thing. They learn to adapt and grow to become resilient and functional adults who can navigate the everyday pressures of life. Different outcomes emerge when a child is exposed to prolonged experiences, child abuse, a chaotic home, community violence, social isolation, profound poverty, and the like. Those very same brain responses that are adaptive in a child with a stable upbringing, flight, fight, or freeze, make a child from a threatening environment vulnerable to troubles in the external world. As stated by Dr. Perry, quote, their baseline state of arousal is activated. When a stressor arises, that child can escalate to a state of fear very quickly. Their traumatic backgrounds mean they have less capacity to tolerate normal stressors as compared to their more resilient peers. It is one thing for a clinician to understand the role trauma plays in the early development of emotional, behavioral, and psychiatric disorders in children. That is, after all, our area of study. There's a movement today, however, that challenges laypeople, teachers, and parents and neighbors to also understand what it means to be trauma-informed. This is rightfully overwhelming to a layperson. What on earth does it mean to be trauma-informed? Today, we have the great pleasure of speaking with Nathan Swearingen, a Guidance Center clinician from It's About Time, a trauma-informed movement in education. It's About Time is a program based on Dr. Perry's research into how trauma impacts the brain of a developing child. The program uses this research to provide educators the tools to create trauma-informed cultures on primary school campuses. Nathan is a licensed clinical social worker. He began his career at the Guidance Center some 15 years ago as a therapist in our school-based program. After years of seeing firsthand how trauma-based behavior is misunderstood as a bad child, Nathan sought out training from Dr. Perry on how to create trauma-informed schools. The It's About Time program was formed. So welcome, Nathan. Thank you for joining us today. You know, I have the advantage of knowing you for over a decade now from our roles at the Guidance Center. But for our audience, will you please share a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for having me. It is a pleasure to do this, and I'm really excited. I've been at the Guidance Center since an intern in 2005, so many, many years. And I was in the school-based program for most of that time. And in 2016, I had the pleasure of talking to you about starting up a new program, a new idea called It's About Time, Trauma-Informed Movement and Education, where I would use the knowledge I had as a clinician and always been really interested in expanding my knowledge of trauma and why these clients and students were struggling with what they were struggling with. So to transition from the role of a clinician to a consultant, to where I could provide this knowledge to the teachers and the school staff, to where instead of having, you know, a caseload of maybe 20 or 25 students that I was working directly with, I was working with the entire school to maybe even have the opportunity to impact the lives of hundreds or thousands of students. So that's what I've been doing ever since 2016, and it's just a pleasure and a privilege to get to do what I do.
Excellent. Thank you. I'm going to dive right in. Nathan, please explain what we mean when we talk about the impact of chronic stress or trauma on the developing brain. What role does the brain play in a traumatic reaction?
Well, two things. I think the first thing that is important to understand is that the brain controls everything, not just when we're talking about trauma or chronic stress. We have to understand the importance of the brain in who we are. The brain modulates our behaviors, our, you know, our digestion, our body functions, our thoughts, our feelings, our actions, our beliefs. Those are all modulated by how our brain has been formed, both by genes and also largely by the environment. So if the environment has been stressful, especially overwhelmingly stressful, then the brain is going to develop as a reflection of that. So that's kind of the first thing to know is, you know, the importance of the brain. And when we're looking at trauma and we're looking at these behaviors, we really need to look at it as a biological, anatomical, physical entity. And the second thing we need to understand is that I think trauma, and especially trauma-informed, is actually a poorly defined concept, even though I'm really excited in this whole trauma-informed movement, not just in what we do here at the Guidance Center, but not just nationwide, but worldwide. It's really becoming a hot issue, and for good reason, because it's so important to know about trauma. But there isn't quite a unifying definition yet. Some people think of trauma as, you know, PTSD, which it certainly is. Some people think of trauma as ACEs or adverse childhood experiences, which it certainly is. But I think it's still really a nebulous gray concept. And we need to really define it for what we're talking about in our discussion here is the way when I say trauma, I mean an experience or pattern of experiences that causes physiologically our stress response system to be overly sensitive. So it's not the events that happen to you, it's what those events do to calibrate your stress response to be more sensitive. And in addition to that, trauma isn't, in my opinion, in my view, a black or white thing. It's not like, okay, person A has trauma, person B doesn't have trauma. It's on a spectrum. And the question is, to what degrees have these overwhelming stressors shaped your nervous system to be overly sensitive? Some people who have had tremendous overwhelming stressors have a very overly sensitive nervous system. Some people have a moderate overly sensitive nervous system, and some people have a mildly or even situational overly sensitive nervous system. And those are all different flavors of trauma. And, you know, by that definition, it's kind of like, well, everybody at some point in their life has had overwhelmingly stressful events to where they're not coping as they should. And for the vast majority of people, we would call maybe neurotypical, those events are few and far between, and we're able to be resilient from them very quickly. We've all had experiences where it's finals week and we're stressed out, we're not sleeping well, or we're having problems with our you know, intimate relationships, and we're behind on bills, and maybe we got a parking ticket, and these overwhelming stressors are just too much, and we have a hard time controlling our behaviors, we have a hard time controlling our emotions, and we're not ourselves. But once those things pass, we are able to kind of tap into our resiliency and go back to our baseline. But with someone who has had overwhelmingly chronic developmental stress, those periods of difficulty with their functioning are more frequent and more intense and more easily triggered. So that's the difference. Everybody has these moments, and everybody has a nervous system that at time can be overly sensitive. It's just how frequently and how intense is it leading to pathology and significant impairment in your functioning is the question. So by that definition, it's really helpful to clarify that the program, It's About Time, isn't just for the extremely impaired students. Of course, they're the ones that are most misunderstood, and they're the ones that are going to benefit the most from having a clarity of understanding why they're struggling and what we need to do to help them. But all students, all human beings, all teachers, all staff, we have these moments of when we're not handling stress well. So It's About Time isn't just for the fringe students who are struggling. It's for all students, all adults, all families, all communities to support them when they're having a hard time managing their stress, when things aren't going as well as they should. So the last thing I'm going to say is that I'm talking a lot about stress, and I really need to emphasize that stress isn't a taboo. Stress isn't bad. In fact, stress is necessary to develop a healthy stress response. It's just when stress is overwhelming, it's unpredictable, it's uncontrollable, that is when it sensitizes our stress response to be overly sensitive. So the analogy that I like to give is like weightlifting or training for a marathon or training for cardiovascular improvement. You know, doing those things, lifting weights, is mildly stressful for your muscles. So you push yourself to the point where you can tolerate, and then you give yourself a break. And then you push yourself to what you can tolerate, and you give yourself a break. And over time, you're actually dosing yourself with stress to make yourself stronger and stronger. But if you were to lift more weight than you could tolerate for a longer duration than you could tolerate, you would actually tear your muscles or weaken your muscles, and you'd be weaker in the long term. So that's kind of an analogy of chronic overwhelming stress, what it does to our brains. Whereas, you know, the normal everyday stressors of, you know, dealing with school or dealing with relationships or whatever that, you know, all human beings have to deal with, all human beings have those stressors, but they're not overwhelming to the point where it's metaphorically tearing our muscles, and we get better and better at tolerating stressors.
We all experience stress, and sometimes severe stress, as you've pointed out. As an example, an entire generation of children witnessed 9/11. We have earthquakes, tornadoes, hurricanes, condos that collapse. Explain for us, please, why chronic stress is harder on a child than episodic exposure to scary events.
Right. I think it's a very important question. And although intensity and frequency, which is kind of what you're describing, is incredibly important to consider as far as what may be constituted as trauma and recalibrate a nervous system to be extra sensitive, those are very important variables, but actually they're not the main variable to consider. The most important variables to consider on whether or not these events are going to cause a sensitized nervous system is actually two things: timing and then your access to relational supports. So when I say timing, I mean, when did these events happen, whether they're chronic or acute episodic stressors? The younger you are, actually, is kind of contraindicated to what most people think. Even if you don't have a conscious narrative memory of it as a young child, as an infant, or even in utero, trauma is not in your cognition necessarily, it's in your nervous system. So the nervous system is developing much, much more rapidly early in birth. I mean, exponentially more rapidly, by the factors of thousands of neural connections, the more young a child is versus the brain slows down. The brain is always growing and changing and adapting to the environment, but exponentially slower later on in life. And we see how young children are able to learn languages, you know, super easily, even three or four languages. Yet as an adult, it's very difficult. So if they're able to have brains that are spongy and absorb all of these experiences in the environment, trauma is no different. So the timing is very important to understand. And also the access to relational supports is, research shows, is the number one variable. Despite what happened, whether it's a chronic stressor or an episodic stressor, the access to relational supports is the greatest mitigating factor for resiliency. So with that said, let me go back to your question. Chronic stress tends to, by definition, usually be related to things in the environment that are inescapable for the whole family, right? We're talking about poverty. We're talking about mental illness in the home. We're talking about, you know, the parents or the caregivers' own depression or anxiety or trauma generationally, or racism or substance abuse, these things that are in the family. Chronic stress tends to be those things, right? Or neighborhood violence. Those things are impacting everyone in the family, not just the child. And when those things are happening, it is inhibiting the buffering supports from providing that buffering. So that is kind of the real reason why these chronic stressors are usually more detrimental than a periodic acute stressor. You know, if there's an earthquake or a hurricane, it happens to the whole family, but usually families come together and provide support and help you build your house. You know, what can we do to help you? So that's kind of the distinction of why chronic stress is usually much more insidious.
So Dr. Perry wrote, and I quote, "The very adaptive responses that help the child survive in a chaotic and unpredictable environment puts that child at a disadvantage when outside that context." What does that mean? Explain that for our listeners.
Right. So this is going to be talking a lot about a concept of neural development called use dependence, meaning that although genes do play a role in, you know, the people that we are and how our brain develops, so much of brain functioning is use dependent, meaning that areas for language acquisition need to be activated by exposure to that language. You know, there's no gene for speaking French. If a brain is able to encode and understand and regurgitate the French language, it's because it's been exposed to those French sounds and been correlated to, you know, the objects of what they mean in French. So much of the brain is use dependent, and the brain becomes a reflection of the environment that it has been exposed to. So with that said, if the brain has been exposed to chaotic, stressful environments and fear, and the world is a dangerous place and relationships are dangerous, relationships are untrustworthy, there's no one here to soothe me at the neurological level, if that's what the brain has experienced, the brain is going to use dependently adapt those skills to survive. It's going to view the world and react to the world and develop a very sensitive stress response because the brain's experience is that the world is not safe. So it's going to develop traits to make sure that it keeps us alive. That's the brain's number one function, is to keep us alive into maturity so we can pass on our DNA to the next generation. So it's going to default to survival. And if that's what the world has been like, then it's going to develop a lot of coping skills that are through the lens of this world is unsafe and I need to survive, which is much lower in the functioning of the brain. It's not up in the cortex. It's not up in judgment and reasoning. And it's really difficult, those things, because the survival brain can't tell time. And I think the most common example is, you know, with true PTSD, and maybe a war veteran is coming back from combat, and, you know, he's been around a lot of explosions and loud noises that his brain has associated with a life-threatening experience, which is completely accurate because that's what it was. And now that he is out of that environment, maybe even many months or many years later, he's back home in a safe environment with no gunshots, no explosions, and he hears a car backfire or he hears a firecracker, his brain doesn't have the ability to tell time and say, wait a minute, you're home safe, don't have a survival response, right? So that's what we're seeing with a lot of brains that are exposed to a lot of chaos. And the distinction is that it doesn't necessarily have to be an exact literal association like the one I just gave. A car backfire sounds a lot like a gunshot. when we're dealing with sensitized brains, those things do happen, these evocative cues. That's a big part of trauma reaction, but it's not just those specific things. So let me give you an example. A traumatized, overly sensitized brain is reactive to those specific cues, but it's also more reactive to all stressors. Their window of tolerance and their stress threshold is much narrower, right? We all have a stress threshold where we're pushed to our limit, and, you know, once we exceed that, we start reacting a little bit more primitively and emotionally. But someone who has a sensitized brain has a very narrow window of tolerance, and any stressor can elicit a survival response. So this, I've seen on YouTube, actually, some of these combat veterans with PTSD, it's not the car backfired that triggers them. They're sitting in traffic, and they have road rage, which is a normal stressor for anybody. Hey, I want to go somewhere, and I can't go somewhere. Most people, that's a mild stressor. But for them, it exceeds their window of tolerance, and they get out of their car on the freeway and start headbutting the window of the car in front of them. Not because they're choosing to act that way, but because their brain has been sensitized to not tolerate any stressors well, and that's what we're seeing in school. We're seeing these children not necessarily reacting to specific stressors, which they do, but just general stressors of having to sit still, learn a boring lesson, you get out in tetherball. These children will have these trauma responses that are maybe not even necessarily connected to a specific evocative cue, which makes it really difficult.
So, Nathan, you know, in your example of the war veteran who perhaps has PTSD, that sounds to me as a clinician like that veteran is experiencing a state of sort of hyperarousal. They're very agitated. Hyperarousal, what in layperson's terms we might think of more as fight or flight. Describe for us, if some further examples, what might a hyperarousal response look like in real life?
Right. And so I'll give some examples of especially what you might see in schools, but it could be with adults too. Hyperarousal can look like impulsivity. It can look like hyperactivity, sensory seeking, distractibility, you know, a really short attention span. It can look like being really quick to anger or fighting or aggression. It can look like standoffishness or defiance, you know, everything needs to be my way. And it can also look like what we call in school eloping or literally running out of the classroom. So those are some common examples of hyperarousal that we see.
And what sort of events might trigger a fight or flight or state of hyperarousal in a child with a background of chronic stress?
Well, it's a really complicated question, but I'll try to simplify it. Again, we're going back to kind of use dependence of what the brain has experienced and what tools it has found it at its disposal to need to survive. So I think it makes sense to assume that an environment of fear and chaos and danger and unpredictability and, you know, being overpowered could potentially and usually produce these types of survival adaptations. But with that being said, a caveat is that these behaviors, these hyperarousal behaviors, don't necessarily have to come from violence. You know, some might find it insulting, like, you know, my child really struggles with a short attention span and impulsivity and anger, but he doesn't come from a violent home. My home isn't violent. And that's true. It doesn't have to come from violence. These things, again, are coming from a nervous system that doesn't handle stress very well. And of course, violence and chaos can produce a nervous system that doesn't handle stress very well. But a nervous system can become sensitized that way, not just from when bad things happen, but when good things don't happen. And I'll elaborate on that, meaning that maybe there isn't violence and chaos, but there is a home where the parents are stressed themselves. They're doing the best they can to work through poverty. They're preoccupied. They love their child, and they're doing everything in their power. But they're dealing with racism and poverty and multi-generational trauma and maybe their own depression or anxiety. And there's no abuse or chaos or anything insidious going on in that home. But the type of developmental experiences that would produce a neurotypical, healthy functioning stress response system are maybe lacking at at nobody's fault, but those are just the situations of the home being a stressful environment, even though it's not really insidious.
Let me back up. So you just described examples of the kinds of things that might make up a background of chronic stress. What I meant is, let's say there's a child sitting in a classroom. They come from a childhood experience of just chronic stress, poverty, whatever it might be. That child sitting in the classroom, what might trigger in that child then a state of hyperarousal or trigger those bad? Do we need a major event in the classroom to get them agitated or acting out? Or what I'm saying is, you're sitting there, you have this history of chronic stress, you're in the classroom, what might trigger you?
Got you. Okay, yeah, that's a very important question. So it could be one of two things, and I kind of touched upon this earlier, but I'll give examples in the classroom. So it could be a specific evocative cue that is most likely unconscious. So let's give the example of a child who unfortunately had an abusive, explosive, alcoholic father. And now that he goes to school and he's had all female teachers who have been wonderful and he hasn't had any problems. And then, you know, in third or fourth grade, he has a male teacher who's not explosive, not violent, not an alcoholic. But his brain has some template deep down in his subconscious that males are potentially dangerous. So just having a male teacher, let alone if maybe he raised his voice, not even in anger, but in excitement, okay, boys and girls, let's get ready for recess. This child may have a hyperarousal response. So that is one type of evocative cue. And another type of evocative or another type of trigger for a stress response might not necessarily be an evocative cue. It may be just that this child has a narrower window of tolerance for any stress. So there's nothing specifically triggering this child's stress response, but having to sit still and focus and learn boring material and navigate social relationships, having to share your paints and crayons can be difficult for anyone, but most people can navigate those things without melting down. But a sensitized nervous system has a much more difficult time navigating normal stressors. So it could be an evocative cue, it could just be difficulty navigating normal stressors, or both.
You know, one thing I used to say to my clients is, you know, let's say that I have a teacup and my teacup is pretty full already and yours is relatively empty. A few more drops of tea in my cup is going to make it spill over, whereas you have room to fill it. So those same number of drops in your cup isn't going to cause a problem. Would you consider that sort of a reasonable layperson's analogy?
Oh, it's beautiful. I love that better than the actual analogy of window of tolerance, because you have to kind of draw a box or like a bar graph and kind of show, okay, you know, most people's window is this full, but, you know, someone with a sensitized nervous system, their window is more full, and then when you exceed it. So I like your example much better. But yes, exact same concept.
We actually, that's become code in our family. If someone's feeling stressed out, we say, my teacup is full.
Right.
So let's talk for a minute about sort of the opposite response to hyperarousal, which is disassociation, freezing or tuning out. And first of all, what I want to get to is, how is that maladaptive? And let me give you an example. I had to have a tooth pulled. I'd cracked it. I had to have a tooth pulled. And I was at the dentist, and they kept chatting to me. And I told them to stop talking because I was actively dissociating. I wanted to pretend I wasn't there. And they were interrupting my flow by trying to engage me in conversation. So how is freezing or tuning out maladaptive?
Right. And that's actually a really good example. I'm going to start by saying, in the moment, these things are incredibly adaptive. To your point, you know, your body needed to dissociate to free you from the anxiety or the pain or the discomfort. The same thing with arousal response. Having to fight or be hypervigilant kept that individual alive in the moment. So in the moment, they're incredibly adaptive. But once they're outside of the survival situation and they're back to an objectively safe environment, that's when these traits can become maladaptive. So a nervous system that is conditioned to dissociate is going to have difficulty focusing, zoning out. They're going to be daydreaming. They may have emotional numbness, or some may see that as lack of motivation or apathy. And also what you're seeing is this explains cutting behaviors. It's a whole nother topic, but I'll just leave it there. And something that people, I think, don't really understand is that dissociative people are also tend to be overly compliant. So this is where you see the followers who normally have good morals, but they are so conditioned to please that they're the ones that people take advantage of. They're the ones that become victimized. They're the ones who are willing to do maybe unlawful things just to fit into the crowd because they're lacking this connection. So yeah, all of those things are really maladaptive, and they tend to fall through the cracks because they're the quote unquote good student who's quiet, who's failing and behind academically, but they're not a problem. So they fall through the cracks. So yeah, it's very maladaptive.
Would the triggers be the same as for hyperarousal? For example, would the same child experience both sort of sides of the reactions versus hyperarousal versus the freezing and the tuning out? And would the triggers be the same?
Yeah, this is a really, really complicated question that I think requires a lot of really complicated neuroscience. But in a nutshell, I would say yes, all people tend to have hyperarousal responses and dissociative responses. But as clinicians and even lay people, we tend to see that some people tend to default to one or the other. And the big difference for people that default to dissociative responses is the variable of lack of agency and lack of helplessness. So if they feel like they couldn't escape their situation, like you in the dentist chair, then the brain will go to a dissociative state. So in the classroom, it could just be an evocative cue, or it could be their nervous system has been shaped to not tolerate stress very well, so their default is to dissociate, where others' default is to be hyper aroused. But in terms of what's happening in the classroom, they could be the exact same things. It's just their toolkit is different depending on what their traumas have been.
That notion of lack of agency or sort of a sense of helplessness over escaping your scary situation makes me wonder, for example, if a child who has a prolonged history of sexual abuse might be more likely to be dissociative than hyper-aroused, because that notion of escaping, because you escape mentally because you can't escape physically.
Exactly right. And you would say, one could argue, well, if a child is growing up with domestic violence, that child can't escape that environment either. You know, they can't just pack up their bags and leave, and they can't necessarily fight off the perpetrator. But there might be some sort of mild agency in throwing a tantrum or fighting or being very hypervigilant, that they're not stopping what's happening and they're not escaping what's happening, but there is some sort of agency that what they're doing is helping, at least interpreted by their nervous system. Whereas sexual abuse, you are completely at the mercy of whoever is mistreating you. So yes, I agree with you.
You know, this has been really fascinating, and let's assume that after listening to this, you know, our listeners or all of us, we're more able to recognize what might be going on when we see these sorts of behaviors in a child. Let's say we can recognize that, and maybe instead of thinking, what the heck is wrong with that kid, we might think, what has happened to this kid? So we can understand where we might be witnessing a traumatic reaction rather than a bad kid. But what next? It's one thing to understand. It's one thing to sort of respond accordingly. How should that understanding change our own response?
Right. And this is a huge point of clarity for the work that we do with It's About Time, is that ultimately, yes, we want to help the children, but it's really an adult-centered program, is we're helping the adults, one, understand that, and like your question, assuming they understand that, what is the next step? The next step is to make sure that the adults are okay. Make sure the adults feel supported and regulated, because even you or I guess I should speak for myself, I know all this, but when I'm dysregulated, I don't always practice what I preach, at least with my own children, right? So we're all human, and you know, we can have moments of not being so proud of our ability to manage our stress responses. So the first and foremost thing is making sure the adults are regulated. What, even after they know this, have this new lens of understanding and being trauma-informed, we need to make sure they're okay and regulated so they can access and utilize this lens. So once they understand that this child is struggling, it completely changes their emotional response, right? So it shifts the lens of the child behaving badly versus they're struggling with something. So having that new lens should produce empathy and hopefully combat frustration. Again, we're human. There's going to be times when we're frustrated, but if the adult feels supported, then the response coming from compassion is much easier to connect with these children and provide them the types of things that they need, which I'll answer your question right now. What should the response be? It should be through the lens of regulation. The adult, assuming the adult is regulated and feels compassion about, yes, whoa, this student isn't behaving badly, they're struggling with something, what should I do? The first thing they should ask themselves is, why is this child dysregulated and what can I do to help them be regulated? Because trying to reason with them, trying to plead with them, trying to threaten them, or trying to help them remember the rules or the consequences of their behavior, of course those things are necessary, but they're not going to be able to access those skills of analyzing and having good problem solving if they're not regulated. So the adult needs to first focus on, okay, why is this child dysregulated? And going back to those evocative cues, you know, maybe the adult knows that this child comes from domestic violence, so a loud voice may be triggering them. Okay, remember that. Keep that in mind and, you know, try to keep your voice low and calm. Or whatever other evocative cues that we have to help educate this teacher, they can try to avoid those things. And another big thing is understanding what doses of stress that this child can tolerate, right? And it goes back to having a full teacup. I'm not going to use the window of tolerance anymore. If this child can only tolerate, you know, 10 minutes of instruction, and at the 11-minute mark, they start getting squirrely. At the 12-minute mark, they start getting defiant. At the 13-minute mark, they start really being disruptive. Why are we pushing this child past their full teacup? Why do we keep adding drops? We're realizing that he's not choosing to be this way. He's not choosing to be disruptive. It's that his teacup is full. So looking at it through a lens of regulation, okay, he can only tolerate 10 minutes and then he gets dysregulated. So maybe I can put in some things in place at the 9-minute mark to help empty his teacup so he can tolerate that. And that would be regulatory activities, utilizing the relationship. And again, it's not just for the really at need children. These are activities that would benefit the whole classroom. Even though maybe they can tolerate 20 minutes of instruction, it's gonna help to take a little brain break, a movement break. And you know, I'm sure we'll talk about this later in the interview, but those type of regulatory activities, being proactive, being mindful of not exceeding this child's window of tolerance or not overflowing their teacup, is exactly what we're doing. And going back to the weightlifting analogy, if we don't push them past their overfull teacup, if we don't force them past what they can lift with their muscles, we push them right to the edge, and then we make sure we're being sensitive to that. Push them to the edge, make sure we're being sensitive to that. We're ultimately recalibrating their stress response to be more resilient and more hardy, right? It's kind of like a crutch. Some people will say, well, you're babying them. It's a crutch. Yeah, I agree. But what is a crutch? If you have a hurt foot, a crutch is enabling your foot to gain back its strength so it can ultimately return to resiliency.
So is kind of what you're saying, you know, if we, that child who can't tolerate more than 10 minutes, if we for a while make sure we stop at 9 and do brain breaks or regulatory activities, ultimately over time, maybe that child can withstand 15 minutes of instruction?
Exactly. Exactly right.
Is that, you know, this sounds wonderful, and it sounds not terribly hard to accomplish in some ways, but I'm a clinician. So is it a lot to hope that lay people are really going to recognize and engage with a child who's having a traumatic reaction to a normal event? Our teachers are there to educate. Foster parents, oh my gosh, their plates are full. Are we asking too much of people to really understand this?
And my answer to that question would be yes. If we were asking just these people to be the agent of change, to it's all on your shoulders to quote unquote fix this child, yes, that would be too much. That's unfair. But the reality is that we're not asking that. It is very difficult, and I will be the first to acknowledge that. It's a very difficult job. Being this person who is very patient and compassionate with this very difficult child, a lot of times that person becomes the punching bag, sometimes literally, but usually metaphorically, where this child is feels safe with this person to really let out all of their pain that they're holding in and trying their best to cope with these things. So yeah, it's very difficult, and it's very unfair. And we're human again, and we all have our own stressors. But the reality is that I've said it a million times, you don't have to be a therapist to be therapeutic. And it's not so much about that one teacher or that one foster parent. That it's unrealistic. That's not fair. It's not even about the one therapist. The healing doesn't come from that 1 hour a week in the therapist office. It doesn't come from just that teacher. What it's about time is hopefully preaching is that it's unrealistic for one person or even two people to be the agent of change. It's about creating a culture of dozens of adults that are treating all the children this way. So looking at the really high needs children, yes, he's with that teacher most of the time, but there are going to be times when that teacher does need to teach the 29 other children. And that's where you have a plan in place where that student, if they're having a hard time and they're not receptive to being regulated in the classroom, you have five or six other people that could maybe utilize their relationship with this child to help out that teacher. You have recreational aides, you have the librarian, you have the custodian, you have other people in the community. And let's not underestimate the power and compassion of children, right? A lot of times a teacher will say, there's one of me and there's 29 other children, and I have one or two really difficult children that are disrupting the whole classroom. It's not fair to the other children. You're absolutely right. But what you can do if you're focused on not just that one child, but again, it's about time being about providing these type of experiences for every child. You're going to create a community where all children are benefiting from this and feeling like a village, right? And going to the adage, it takes a village. You will see one student having a hard time, and you'll see three or four of his peers soothing and supporting him. It's okay. He's just having a hard time. Here, you know, let me help you. Remember, Billy, take a deep breath. And it's just this beautiful thing to see even children as young as kindergarten helping other children. And that's not to put the burden on the children. This is an adult model. But when you create the community of this lens, it becomes contagious. And you have dozens, if not hundreds or thousands of people willing to be that proverbial village. It's not all on the shoulders of one or two people.
So it's changing the whole community.
Exactly. And let's not forget about the parents, too.
Thank you, Nathan. No matter how many times I hear this, I always enjoy listening to you and your perspectives on trauma and how we can all join together to change the world. So thank you for your time today.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me. And again, thank you so much for allowing me to do what I do, because, you know, I'm so blessed, and hopefully the passion comes through. So thank you.
It does. Thank you, Nathan. We've learned today that prolonged stress in children actually alters the brain, where the child's baseline state of arousal changes. As Dr. Perry wrote, the traumatized child lives in an aroused state, ill-prepared to learn from social, emotional, and other life experiences. She is living in the minute and may not fully appreciate the consequences of her actions. The problems then snowball. The child acts impulsively and understands their own behavior from a context of I am bad or I am stupid. They struggle in school and in relationships, and that message is reinforced. Adults around them respond with frustration and escalating discipline, and the cycle continues. This would all be quite depressing to think about if we didn't know that the amazing human brain can also be altered back in healing ways. One of the most effective tools to change a child's brain response is something we can all access, the interpersonal relationship. In our next episode, I hope to empower our listeners through a conversation with Stevie McBride. Stevie is another clinician from the Guidance Center's It's About Time program, a trauma-informed movement in education. Stevie will take what we've learned theoretically from Dr. Perry and Nathan about trauma in the brain and turn it into practical and easy things we can all do in our daily lives to have a positive impact on a traumatized child's life. I hope you will join us for episode 9 to learn more.
In My Backyard is brought to you by the Guidance Center, a children's mental health agency in Long Beach, California. In My Backyard is produced by Tricia Costales and Matthew Murray. Thank you to J. Vincent B. for original music. All other music licensed through Soundstripe. Thank you to our listeners and supporters. Please visit tgclb.org or text HOPE to 562-262-5689 to make a one-time donation or join our Hope and Healing Club to become a monthly donor today. Subscribe to In My Backyard on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.